They do not like to wait. Do you like to wait in lines and in traffic? And you say, I hope I can get to church on time. I hope this is going to happen. Well, the idea of hope means that it's out ahead. And so sometimes we begin tonight by even talking in this matter with the depressed. And so let's say we sat down and again, I'll use Greg, and I'm telling Greg comes to me. He's all depressed. And he says, I said, well, I'm so glad you came to our church. I'm so glad that you came here. I just believe that we can give you some hope. Well, we're going to find out what typically a depressed person's reaction, because what goes through their grid is, I don't have hope. There's not such a thing to me. And that means I can't get an answer right now, and you're not going to be able to help me today. I have to wait a little bit more. Isn't it interesting that Hebrews records that faith is the evidence of things not seen and the substance of things hoped for? We are not at our final destination. Your address now is not a permanent address. And if you downsize and move, you're still not going to be at your permanent address if you know Jesus. Because your permanent address is with Him. And it will be unbelievable. More of an incredible experience than we could even attempt to describe. So in saying that, we are going to look at the process of giving hope. But there's things that we have to do, and you see that on your opening sheet, and it's on the screen for you, which Steve has so adequately done for us these last night and then even last week with the time in church here, for which we appreciate. We're going to look at decoding depression's diet. In other words, what do we have to understand feeds depressed people? What locks them up? We're going to talk about the disguise that we have to go through. We're going to dismantle. We're really going to look at depression's deceit, and then we're going to dismantle its demands. We're going to discover its dynamics. That's where we'll look into Sheld Shelley. And then we're going to finish with defeating depression's dominance. What can we do about it? So that's where we're headed. Let's talk about the very first idea, and that is decoding depression's diet. Why is it so difficult for counselors, or why would it be so difficult for you to help someone who is depressed? First of all, because of the emotions. The emotions of the depressed, as we said last night, we're not going to repeat this, but the emotions are so bleak. Things are so bad. The situation of despair seems so overwhelming. But as we go through these ideas tonight versus last night I tried to give you a picture and a description and to show you clearly where the cancer cells were. Tonight, as we go through these ideas, I want to try to bridge the gap between what is the problem and how we can help. And we're going to start right now with emotions, this idea of emotions. Let's think about this. Why the confusion in relationship to depression's emotions? And the first idea I want to talk about, and we'll look at this slide, and that is, I call it overtaken or revelation. And when we consider emotions, we're going to consider these three ideas. In other words, people typically say, and you've heard this phrase before, he or she was just overtaken by the emotions of the whole thing. Have you ever watched a we used to do drama presentations, and I'm sure you do some wonderful things here at the church. In fact, Brian said the children are going to be doing some things here coming up. But I grew up, as Pastor did, in Pennsylvania. I grew up in Dutch country. Vaughn is not Italian. It's German. And I grew up learning that men were not supposed to cry. If you were a man, a real man, real men didn't cry. And so I can remember going to one of the first funerals I went to, my aunt's funeral, and everyone went by and looked in the bier, the casket, whatever. And all that I heard, and I'm like 10 years old, I guess, and all that I heard was, "My, she looks nice." I'm thinking, what? I'm thinking as a little child, she's dead. What do you mean she looks nice? I mean, there's not a smile on her face, you know? It's just there. And, you know, so they said, everybody, you know, that was the comment. She looks nice, and they went and had coffee. So that's what there was no crying. And so I learned this behavior of not crying. But the older I got and the more I got into the Bible, the more I appreciated how much God talked about brokenness and tears and contriteness. So whether it was wise to do so, I was appreciative to me, but I began praying, "Lord, help me to be able to cry. Help me to have tears. Help me to be able to feel for people when they're going through difficulty and pain." Well, I can recall us having drama presentations at the university, and the drama team would do something, and the gospel would be clear, and I would be sitting there, and all of a sudden tears would be running down my cheeks, and I'd be crying, and I had to run out to get some cheap Kleenex at the restroom, and grabbed the roll and pulled it down and blew my nose and said, you know, I don't know if I'm supposed to be doing this crying or not. I'm a faculty member. I'm a vice president here. What am I supposed to be doing this crying for? But I was grateful that God gave me tears. Now, someone would have observed me. They may have said, "Well, Dr. Vaughn, watch this, because here's the secret when we're going to help depressed people. Dr. Vaughn was overtaken by the emotion of the presentation of the play. The performers were so good. The truth was communicated so well that it just overtook him." False. You are not overtaken by emotions. You say, "Well, I don't think I'm agreeing with you." Wait a minute. Let me finish. Your emotions are emitted from your heart because of what you are. That play or that drama struck a chord in your heart that God used to release those emotions. That's extremely significant when you're dealing with a depressed person, because a depressed person feels like they're under this emotional cloud, that they're in this emotional prison. That's really not biblically true. The truth of the matter is their emotions are there because of what's in their heart. I was talking about you today, Bill. Good things, good stuff. Pastor was complimenting you on some things. He said you're part of his team. And I said, "Well, one thing I do know, you have a happy fighter on your team. So if he likes to win, and he's got the spirit to do it." Why? Because I get the sense, being around him, that he's appreciative of what God has done in his life. Correct? when that heart, when something happens in my heart, it releases my emotions. And so if we're going to help depressed people, we have to understand when they tell us, you know, I'm just, and they are. We proved that last night. I'm just in this emotional smog. Everything is so dim and it's not worth going on and I can't go on. But as a helper or as a counselor, I'm saying, you are just telling me what's in your heart. And that's why we have to reinterpret for them, and we're going to talk about that. And we have to connect them, and you'll remember this from last night. We have our emotions reflect our God connectedness. Listen to this. I don't like it. It smacks me right in the face. It hammers me right to the core of where I live. But if I'm all, listen now, if I'm all emotionally upset over something, I am revealing my heart. That person on the job, I'm telling you, he makes me so nervous. She makes me so upset. No, sir. No, ma'am. I'm not going to let you all get away with it, okay? Because you're going to be helping others, okay? Because God doesn't let us get away with it. You are revealing and telling what's inside you. And I'm going to say this probably 3 or 4 times tonight. Our problems are not what's outside of us. Our problems are what's inside of us. And we really have to buy into that, to buy into biblical truth. And it's all spread throughout the pages of Scripture. And so, when someone upsets me, I'm upset because of who I am on the inside, not because of them. And so here's a person, we're going to talk about Shelley tonight. She's upset with her husband who's acting like a jerk, about to lose his job. Doesn't spend time with her and the children. Just not a good husband. And she's allowing it to depress her. And she tells you as a counselor, this is why I'm depressed. We're going to have to help Shelley understand something that's different than that. So that's the idea of emotion, is something that has to be decoded if we're going to help people. Second, let's talk about experiences, because they play into the issue of our decoding and understanding emotion. Understanding depression. Experiences can be so many. We see, obviously, past life events. Look, all of us have bitter realities of the past. Let me ask you a question. And it's wonderful to have this type of group of people here, because you can... I just appreciate you coming, and we can just go right to where the rubber meets the road. Is there anyone in here, you have never experienced hurt in your life? No one's ever said anything unkind to you or about you. No one's ever done any unkind act towards you. You've never felt or experienced hurt. If you're afraid to raise your hand, come and talk to me afterwards. I have never met a person who has not experienced hurt. We live in a broken world, don't we? And life is a broken mess sometimes, and we all have experienced hurt. But some people have experienced the bitter realities of the past more than others. And their experiences of the past, their losses, their disappointments, maybe somebody has been brutal to them, or somebody has betrayed them in some way, they've been through some trauma, and these past events kind of clutter their mind in relationship to getting rid of depression. And so So we have to help the person, we have to help the person decode this idea of their past experiences. We have to show them biblically, this is how you can bring closure and put this to rest. In the future, we'll attempt to do a seminar. We do another seminar called, Why Do People Do What They Do? Why are people so messed up anyway? You ever wondered that? What is wrong with people? Well, and we'll tear that apart and we'll look at it at some point. But one of the things that you're going to find in dealing with people is that I'm going to say 98% just because I don't like to say 100%, but in all of my counseling experiences, what I've found, folks, is that there's a strain, there's a stream, there's a thread of hurt that has happened typically in someone's past. And unless they've brought a biblical closure to that, and someone has taken the Bible and opened the Bible and said, yes, God has forgiven you. You are free from that. But you also have a responsibility horizontally to handle that. How are you going to handle that? How do you handle the young lady who's under depression because her grandfather has morally abused her? And I won't go into the whole story at this point. We'll save that for another seminar. But he was a member of the mafia. And when she told her father about what her grandpa had done, the father wisely and should have taken more action than he did. It was out of my hands. I told her that there are legal responsibilities here. The grandfather was a member of the mafia. And when the father went to talk to, when her father went to talk to the grandfather about what he had done to the daughter, the grandfather was sitting at his desk, the daughter told me. He pulled out a .357 and he pointed it at the father and he said, you ever mention this again, you are a dead man. Either I will kill you or I'll have somebody kill you. What does the daughter do? So she came to me weeping and said, you spoke about bitterness. And she said, I have a past reality of hate toward a member of my family. And she told me the story. And I explained to her how the biblical reality of this. And this is in the news. It's in the news with the university, Bob Jones University, the Grace Report, and all this other stuff that's coming out. Because the secular society has taken it out of biblical hands of how we can counsel people. I have to call police. I have to call an attorney. And you do too if you're talking to someone who has thoughts of suicide and they're depressed. You have a legal responsibility. We have a legal responsibility. It used to be you could handle things within the context of a local church and the body of Christ. Because it has been so explosive and so explicit in our age, we can no longer do things that we used to do. But I told her how biblically she could bring closure and how she could meet with her grandfather. And I have the people who come to counsel me, I have them write a letter, not to send, because I want them to put their thoughts and their mind on paper. I want the Holy Spirit of God to show them where the areas are they need to bring closure. And actually, I was sitting in a restaurant in Green Bay. My wife was doing some Christmas shopping. She was going to dress shops. That's not my particular forte of where to go. I'd rather go to Cabela's or Bass Pro Shop or Golfsmith or someplace. But someone had called me from Green Bay and said this Catholic, this Green Bay cheerleader, the Green Bay Packers, who was a Catholic lady, She said she wants to know what happened to me. And this lady that called me and asked me if I would meet with this cheerleader was a professional golfer that I had the privilege of seeing come to know Christ. And so she said, "Can you come and meet with?" And I said, "Yes, I can. My wife and I will be down there Christmas shopping. Could you set up a lunch appointment?" So I'm sitting there and I'm talking with this sweet. She was really a sweet Catholic lady who just wanted to hear the truth. And as I gave her the truth and showed her the difference between Catholicism and Bible Christianity, and a relationship versus a religion, and she said, "Oh, I now can go straight to God. You mean I can confess my sins and have a relationship with God?" I said, "Oh, yes." I said, "There's such wonderful freedom." I forgot to shut my phone off, and just then my phone rang, and I'm thinking, "Oh, no. Lord, help this lady not to forget what I just said. You're working in her life." So I picked up the phone. I said, because I thought it was my wife saying, "Hey, I'm finished, you know, shopping," and because she had met the folks that I was, the ladies that I was talking with, and she said, "Well, I'll go on and go shopping." And so I picked up the phone, and the voice at the other end of the phone said this: "Dr. Vaughn, I'm free. I'm free. I'm free." I'm thinking, "Who is this? What? And I said, I didn't know what else to say. I said, "Well, tell me about it." She said, "I went to my grandfather. The bitterness is gone." Here was a grandfather who pointed to 357 at her father. I said, "What did? Tell me more." She said, "He put his head down when I talked to him about how he had violated me and that my body was the temple of the Holy Spirit. And how that I had to get the hate out of my heart toward him. And I asked him to forgive me for that hatred." She said, "Dr. Vaughn, I saw a tear come out of his eyes." Why? Because the power of God is not bound by human sin. Greater is he that is in us than he that is in the world. But this young lady experienced such wonderful freedom. You and I have been through some past realities. The depressed person lives in that cloud. We'll talk more about it as we go on here. They say, "I'm ashamed. I'm guilty that there's nothing can be done. I have to be in this state." That's not true. And then there are some, as you see in the second line there, there are some that have committed willful sins that have never been biblically handled. Pastor knows where this town is. Maybe some of you do as well. Lewistown, Pennsylvania. A man who had stolen piece by piece, part by part, a machine from his factory. He was such a genius that he could machine anything, but he knew he needed this machine. He was actually working on a patent to produce something that was going to make him mega bucks. He was a Christian. And he felt like the company owed him something. He stole piece by piece, put this machine together, had it in his house. I mean, not in his house, but in his garage, had it at his home, in his huge garage. When he realized the sin, the willful act of sin that he had done, and he said, "I knew I was guilty." God convicted him, and one morning, about 2 a.m, he got up. The machine was so big, he had to attach it to a hay wagon. Pulled by his pickup truck, he pulled a hay wagon with this huge machine on it. He pulled it into the company lot right by the president of the company's office. And at 6 o'clock in the morning, he was waiting when the president of the company came. He said, "Sir, I have to talk with you. I have to talk with you." He went in and he said, "I am so ashamed. I'm a believer in Jesus Christ. And I stole part by part, built a machine that you see in the hay wagon. I was going to use it to start a business. I have this patent in the works. And God has deeply convicted me of my sin. And I've come to ask you, as the president of the company, to forgive me. He was a superintendent. That's how he could get by with taking things. He was a superintendent. And he said, I'm going to meet with all of my men. I'm going to tell them that I'm a Christian. And I'm going to tell them what I did. And I came to you and I asked your forgiveness and I asked this company's forgiveness. And he said, furthermore, you can have the rights to the patent. And the president said, your name came up yesterday in our company meeting with our corporate board. And we were talking about whether we should promote you to be the vice president, one of the vice presidents of our company. He said, I want you to know you have the promotion. You are going to be one of our vice presidents. I know I can trust you. From living under a cloud of guilt and hurt and a willful act of sin to freedom, there's nothing like it. And then we have human frailties. Remember, we're going through the codes of what we have to get to unlock what people are living in and why they're living there. So there's the aspect of human frailties. What do I mean by human frailties? The tendencies of personality, the temperaments of people. We really have to address the issue here of hormonal changes. I've counseled and this, please understand how I say this. I hope I can say it discreetly and graciously, but I've had pastors call me and church leaders call me and said, I think my wife is going through a life change here. She's just not the same. How do I handle it? Well, I'm not a woman, so I've never gone through that. The only hot flash I ever had was when I got hit by a baseball. It was coming 95 miles an hour at me. And it really burned when it hit me. That's the only thing I've close to having a hot flash. And I'm just saying there is a reality to that. There's a human frailty, okay? Now, we have to address that because that cannot be controlled. And what some people do, that becomes such a stressful and an anxious time for them, particularly as a lady. Men go through a type of crisis as well. You know, you see some of these guys that, you know, are mid to late 40s and 50s and try to fix themselves all up and look like they're 19 again. Forget it. It's not going to work. It's too late for you. You know, those days are over. Please don't take it out on others, you know. And so we have to get help. There's the nutritional help. There are some medications that can help. You have to watch what you're taking. Of course, the disclaimers on that we see regularly. But there are cyclic seasons of life just because of human frailties. And we have to address that. Then there are what I call physical realities. Some people are just tortured by allergies, for example. That doesn't make you feel good if you're sniffing all the time and you're wiping your nose all the time. And I mean, I'm just talking about, you know, biological issues, disabilities. Perhaps you've been diagnosed with a type 2 diabetic situation. Well, there are those physical things. And part of that does fit into the code of our life experiences. And we have to be careful. And this is why we're called on as helpers, as counselors, to really show mercy, to really show love. And because all of these factors add a complexity that have to be decoded. Then we have the entanglements of a secular culture. And so that's what we look at next. I call them entanglements, culture's call. And what does culture say to us? Culture wants to link depression to every other thing that they can link it to. You know, well, it's because you have a seasonal deficiency syndrome. That's why it is. It's because there's stress on you and your job. It's because there's all kinds of links. And the first thing that culture does is to call us to all of these issues and link us to those things. And the call is what? Medication, medication, medication. And so, because that's all they know. Because they, and please, as I explained last night, I am not opposed to medication. But you can see the disclaimers on the commercials as I can of what medication can do and the effects. Fortunately, they have to publish that stuff now. And that's good because people can see the reality of what's happening. But that's all that they know because that's their training. You know? My daughter-in-law is a physician, and so I say to her, you know, there was a missionary that was the missionary's son was going through some things, and I said to my daughter-in-law, I said, let me ask you about this. These are the symptoms. And she sat there for about 20 seconds, and she said, well, Dad, that says to me that there could be one of these 18 things wrong. And she starts calling them off. I can't even pronounce, I couldn't even repronounce what she was saying. And I was saying, well, give me your best guess. Okay? You know, I know there's 18 things. I don't know how you remember, you know, how she remembers all those things. But I looked at her grade point average in med school. I guess I understand now. But, it's like, well, she said, my best guess is this is a problem that's related to the lower intestinal tract. There's probably a parasite in the bowel, because I asked her to interpret what that meant for me. She said, there's a parasite in the bowel. I said, which means, you know, and I got it down till I could understand it, like fourth grade level. And so, and sure enough, that's when they got to the hospital in Johannesburg, that's what it was. So, I mean, praise the Lord. But, you know, this is training. And so the call is for medication, medication, medication. So this is where we have to guard, because those entanglements. And if you're helping someone who is on medication, please don't tell them, well, just stop taking your medication. You can really wreck someone's system. All kinds of systems by doing that. Barbara could tell us that, of what could happen to situations like that. But, you know, that's we have to look out for that. But they only look for symptomatic relief. And then last in the decoding, we would go to the what I would call the exhortations. And this is where we fit in as a church. Because I think Pastor so wisely said this at the beginning when he was talking about the seminar this evening. We can do a better job at helping people. The church is finally becoming more and more aware of their commitment and their ability to get training to really help others in need. It can be a huge evangelistic tool for the church. But the church was weak at giving answers, because the church basically, they had a, you know, just a few years back, the church was saying, you know what you need to do with your situation, you're depressed, right? Well, just read your Bible and pray and it'll go away. It's like, what? Now, reading your Bible is wonderful. Praying is wonderful. But it doesn't decode the mess that you're in, you know? And as many pastors have told me, look, I do all my counseling from the pulpit. If people want counseling, they can go to their doctor. Well, a doctor is not a Christian counselor. And to think that you folks here, really, really, I want you to realize this. You have the ability to help people. You can pray for people. You can help people. You can give them counsel. You say, I don't think I could ever do that. Oh, yes, you can. Listen, everyone is a counselor. Every time somebody calls you and asks you a question, you're giving counsel. You know? Even if it's about, you know, I hear my wife talking, well, I think I'm going to wear this. Well, I think I'm going to wear that. I'm thinking, that's worth a phone call to talk about what you're going to wear? You know, but that's that world that I don't live in, because I don't wear dresses and makeup and all that stuff. At least I haven't in a while. Halloween, I think I did. So how does the church advise? How do they challenge? How can the church become an urgent care center for these folks? It's possible, and that's why you're here. I trust that the Lord will use you. So that's the idea of the what we're going to talk about when we talk about a decoding depression. These are the things that we're talking about. Well, let's move on. And next, let's talk about the diet now, decoding the diet of what feeds depression. That was the idea of why I chose the word diet. What feeds the depression? Now we're going to talk about what is the disguise. What are the attitudes? What are the attitudes that have to be fought off when it comes to counseling with depressed people? And you're going to see these attitudes is very, I think, very, very real and very, very common. What are some of these attitudes? First of all, I want you to consider the idea of inflexibility. Depressed people, when you try to help them, are going to be very inflexible. And that's you know, what we want to talk about first when we consider inflexibility. What do we mean? What do we mean when we talk about their inflexibility? Some people are set in a certain belief system, and they become very inflexible to your help. They tend to be very loyal to what they're thinking, because depression is about what my emotions are telling me. Depression is very much about what I'm thinking and feeling. And so they become very inflexible to their belief system. They almost see themselves as a guilty person, or a person that God has abandoned. And they're set in their ways. Illustration. In fact, one of my family members, a cousin, called me. Her husband had come to know Christ, and this guy had been a drinker. His life was transformed. Everyone on the job said he got religion. He got religion. He got religion. I mean, his life was so transformed. And she called me and she said, you know, my husband's having a struggle. I don't know what's going on. He's very depressed. She said, would you and Susan mind just stopping by, and we'll have some dessert. You know, tell me what night you can come by and we'll have some dessert. I was very happy to help because it was a family member. And she had married this guy. He came to know Christ. Neither one of them were Christians. She came to know Christ. He came to know Christ, and seemed to be really growing in the Lord. So it was, and the last I heard, that's what was happening with him. So it was kind of disturbing to hear that all of a sudden he was going through depression and not responding to the Lord and his continued personal growth. So we went by the house, and I very conveniently let my wife talk with her, and I went in and started talking with him, and we talked about some things. And I said, well, you know what? I'm just so thrilled about your walk with Jesus Christ. And I said, it must be so rewarding. He said, well, I'm going through some things right now. He said, I'm really depressed. And I said, oh, I said, well, tell me what you're thinking. He had a belief system that God would not forgive him for a certain sin that he had committed when he was 13 years old. And, I mean, just being honest, I wish I could say, wow, folks, this was a great success story because I gave him this formula and I told him this truth. I mean, I did tell him truth. But he was so inflexible in his belief system that he said, no one can be forgiven for this sin. And I mean, I'm thinking, the guy didn't kill anybody, surely, when he was 13. I mean, I would have heard about this. Small town, word gets around to what people do. And I'm thinking, what in the world did he do? And he said, I can't even talk about it. Well, he finally told me this one action that he took one time. And it was a morally despicable action. It wasn't done with any relatives or whatever, but it was a morally despicable action. But his belief system said, God can't forgive me for this one time failure. And he became inflexible to counsel. You are going to find that when you try to help some people, if they have a certain belief system, well, the Bible says this, and they grab onto something, and they hold onto that, and don't employ the whole counsel of God. And I told them about forgiveness. I quoted, God remembers our iniquities no more. It's not on God's record, the righteousness of Jesus Christ. Now, the church that he was going to was not what I would call the most solid doctrinal church. I'm not going to name it because I don't think it makes any sense to do so. Although I will say this, the church had a very aberrant belief about eternal security. In other words, that a person could lose their salvation. And I was hoping that my counsel would help him get out of that church. But I didn't want to say anything about his church because he was so on fire and so gangbusters about serving in the church. So I didn't want to deal with that. But I realized that this belief system contributed to his holding on to this particular belief. That was sad. And so you're going to find people like that. And you're going to find it in all kinds of different situations. And you try to explain what this means in the Greek or what this means in the Hebrew from the Old Testament or something. And they're going to say, well, I only use this version of the Bible and it's not here. And you're saying, don't get into that version worship stuff now. Because that's enough to depress people. You start worshiping anything except Jesus Christ, and you're in trouble. You start worshiping a music system, a Bible system, a theological system, apart from God's precious, expressed, clear word, and you're gonna get off and be all kinds of trouble causers. But that's another message, okay? So there's the inflexibility. Second, there's an independence that you're going to have to cut through that's a disguise of depression. What I mean by an independence. Look, watch this. A person may want to get rid of his or her depression. Watch this. But they'll hold on to their anger. Okay? You see a person that's depressed, but over here they're very impatient and very stubborn and a very angry person. Those are connected. And you can't act independently and say, well, I want to get rid of my depression, but I'm still going to be ticked and still people make me mad quick. You're on the wrong track. And so you have to handle what's going on in the heart. And we'll see this more. I want to quickly get through these so we can get to cases and other stuff. Then irresponsibility is certainly another idea that is a disguise. I call this And you'll see this. You see it on the screen. But irresponsibility is what? One big word I had Melanie put on our screen for this evening. Avoidance. This person is depressed because they want to avoid certain things. They want to avoid financial responsibility. They don't want you talking to them about budget. They don't want you talking to them about, you know, financial investment, financial future, financial responsibility. They don't want you to talk about that. So that their whole irresponsibility is creating depression. They don't want to mend this past relationship. They want to avoid. No, I'm going to go to church there because I love our church. But if she sits on that side of the auditorium, I'm sitting on this side of the auditorium. Or if this guy ever comes to our church, I'm going to have to tell Pastor I'm leaving the church. That's avoidance. That's irresponsibility. That person is living under that disguise. And to help them, we have to help them realize, and we'll see this really clear with Shel Shelley tonight. And then there's the aspect, the next one, identity. And again, we're trying to hustle through here. Identity, and that's the idea. We talked about this last night. But you know, Jesus came to the impotent man in John 5. It's a wonderful story there. But it's like, do you want to be made whole? Well, he was thinking about his physical ailment. Jesus was thinking about his soul. But I use that in terms of seeing people who are depressed and counseling them. Sometimes it's like they don't want to get well. And you'll have people like this as you try to help them. They will come and see you and they will tell you about their depression. Then they'll go and see Pastor, and they'll tell him about the depression. Then they'll go and see Jason, and they'll tell Jason about their depression. They'll go and see Chad and tell them. And they just go from one person to the other. I'm depressed. In fact, I've been in seminars where the pastor has warned me. Now, there's this lady. I guarantee you she's going to come to you and tell you she's depressed. And she's been depressed as long as I've been pastor here. And she tells everybody that comes to our church that she's depressed. Even visitors that come to our church. You know? Well, there's comfort in that. That has become her identity, correct? That's me. I can't get out of it. This is good for me. It's like having a martyr's complex. I'm the guilty one. I'm the oppressed one. And then the last idea here to tear away this disguise and this attitude toward depression is just indifference. Indifference. I like to think of this in terms of a preference. In other words, this probably opens a can of worms, but here's a woman who marries a man who she shouldn't have married because he's a very angry man. Her father, listen to this, here's the connection. Her father was a drunk who beat her mother. Okay? But she marries an angry man who takes out his anger on her. And you know what? She feels very comfortable with that. Oh, she hates the anger. She doesn't like his verbal abuse and his verbal cutting. But when you talk to her, it's like she's at home. She never left home. She grew up watching her dad beat her mom. And so that's what home was like. And so now she has a home that's the same way. Only her husband doesn't beat her with whatever. He beats her with words. But she's comfortable in that. And I'm saying that because these things are disguises. These things are disguises for that have to be gone through, where depression can't be dealt with. And if you're going to help these people, these disguises have to be broken and understood, and that's where we're headed tonight. So that's it becomes a comfort to her. That became her preference. That's, it's just like, and you've heard the, my grandmother used to say this, I don't know if it's an old Pennsylvania quote or what, she used to say, well, him marrying her and her marrying him didn't spoil two families, I'll tell you that. And you know, so it's the idea. He was looking for a mother. He wasn't looking for a wife. He wasn't looking for a companion to serve Christ with. He wasn't looking for a purposeful companion. He was looking for someone to take care of him. Do the laundry, spoil him, like his mother did. And probably a wife like that after a while says, why don't you go home to your mother? But so then we have to go to what I call discerning depression's deceit. And we'll cover this and then we will take a break. Are you ready? Because are you with me? Because this is where we start cutting away the veil to the heart. We've talked about the diet that depression lives on. We've talked about the disguise that it hides behind. But now we're going to dig in and get to the real heart. And sometimes it's hard to do this in many ways as a helper or a counselor of the depressed, because you feel like you're confronting them. And very few people enjoy confrontation. David, because of his heart for God, said, before I was afflicted, I went astray. He became a person who employed God's correction and saw God's purposes. But very few people have a heart for God like David did. That's the kind of heart we need to pray for, right? That's the kind of heart we need to embrace. But very few people have that heart. And so what are we dealing with in the heart of the depressed person that they don't understand? And we'll see this. And this begins to open the doors in a new way. What are the heart issues of the depressed? The first one is what I call massive individualism. These are huge factors. Massive individualism. What do I mean by that when I talk about the depressed person in terms of what the heart of the depressed person is really like? And if you're helping a depressed person right now, this is going to be very difficult for you to say directly to them. And so that's why we're kind of going through Shelley tonight, because I want to try to use her as a case to open the door to help you maybe say some things that you can say. And then beyond that, I'm going to give you, probably not tonight, we won't have time, but I'm going to send you a questions that you can ask people. Because questions open the window to a soul. If I just say to Greg, you're depressed, you know what? I appreciate you, I love you, but you got some sin, buddy, you got to get rid of. I didn't open a window to his soul. Depending on how he's feeling that day or what he's been through that day, I may just have closed the window permanently. And he says, I'm depressed. And that guy just thinks I'm just another bad sinner, you know? What is massive individualism? Let me tell you what it is. It's stark. It's radical. Here's what massive individualism is. Nothing is bigger than me. In other words, I am the most important commodity on the planet. And my problem deserves all of your attention. And the only way I'm going to serve at this church is if some of the deacons pat me on the back and let me know I'm doing a good job. The only way I'm going to do something is if Pastor will recognize me from the pulpit. Please recognize me, Pastor, in what I do. Because otherwise I'm going to be depressed. You know what this person's saying? There's nothing bigger on this planet than me. That is one of the huge issues in the heart of an individual. We're going to show you that on a chart after our break. Satisfaction is only what satisfies me. You just tell me how I can get rid of this depression. You just tell me what I can do with my husband. You just tell me what I can do with this child. Because this is depressing me right now. You just tell me how I'm going to get out of this financial mess. Because this is depressing me right now. You just give me this quick answer, real quick. Because I want to be satisfied and I demand that. Can you imagine as a counselor trying to tell a depressed individual that? You have to go, as the saying goes, you have to go around the barn two or three times before you can get there. I was counseling a man one time, and a man and his wife, actually. And she said, this wasn't a depression case, this was a marital situation. And she said, so they sat down and we prayed. And I said, well, help me understand. Tell me what's going on, a little bit about what the problem is. Let me start like this. Why don't, sir, you know, and I call his first name, I said, why don't you tell me if there's three things you could change about your wife, what would it be? He said, no. He said, I can tell you, but I want her to go first. He said, you go first. You're the one that's, you know, here, listen to this. You're the one that set up this appointment. You get to go first. I thought, oh boy, this is going to be fun. So I said, well, ma'am, you know, I said, he's giving you the floor. Tell me three things. She said, oh, there's not three things. There's just one thing. I thought, oh, there's hope. If I could just get him to admit one time that he's wrong, I would be satisfied. And I said, well, how long have you been married? She said, well, 19 years. And so I looked at him and I said, what do you have to say to that? He said, well, this is what I have to say. He said, the only time that I've ever thought that you had to admit you were wrong is when you were wrong. I felt like saying, counseling over. You know? I mean, wow. Talk about massive individualism, huh? I'm never wrong. Some people always have to win. They always have to be right. It's not even about the argument. It's about them winning. You know? It's crazy. And so... I may say this again tonight, but write this down because I think it's a great statement. Never lose your awe. AWE. Never lose your awe of God. Okay? Don't be awestruck by yourself. Don't be awestruck in yourself. Don't look at how good you are. Look at how great the righteousness of Jesus Christ is. Never lose your awe of God. And then, if that's not enough, there's massive indulgence here that can be part of the depressed person's life. What do we mean by massive indulgence? This is the person who seeks, who lives to please himself. Perhaps he's been told, you are great. You can do everything. You deserve. And you just need one more. You just need one more good business deal. You just need one more, piece of lemon meringue pie. You just need one more look at this. You just need one more taste of this drug. You just need one more drink. And these heart issues are connected to these external symptoms of depression. But really what it is massive self-indulgence. Huge factor. Number three, massive idolization. What is this about? Well, you know what an idol is, something you bow down to. I submit to you that people, and we have to watch in our own Christian life, in our own Christian experience, people bow down to the altar of happiness and to the idol of happiness. It's 9 out of 10 times it's when I begin to witness to someone on an aircraft, if I'm flying. And I'll say, have you ever thought, sometimes I'll start the conversation by saying, have you ever thought about, like, what's the most important thing to you in life? You know, they'll be talking, they may say, what do you do? And I'll say, well, I teach seminars around the country. I'm not going to say, I'm an ordained Baptist minister, and I'm here to tell you how to get to heaven. That's not how I'm going to start out. Pardon me for saying that, but that's not how I'm going to start out. So if they are into conversation, and I can initiate a conversation, I may say something like, you know, have you ever thought about, like, what's the most important thing in life, or what's the most important thing to you in life? You ever thought about that? 9 out of 10 times they'll say, yes, I have. I can tell you right now what it is. Just being happy. Just being happy. People bow down to the idol of happiness. Let me ask you, are you happy when you're unhappy? No. Do you get depressed when you're unhappy? Little. But fortunately, it's light depression. You know? Are you happy when your wife doesn't have dinner prepared or she doesn't know what to prepare? And she said, "It's time. This is a night for us to go out to eat." Out to eat? What are you talking about? You know? I've been out. Well, I happen to. What are you saying by that interaction? You don't realize it, but most of our words are about us being happy. Okay? And because people get used to worshiping that idol. Well, there's no one that worships that idol any more than a depressed person. They just want to be happy. They just want the groaning in their mind to stop, the numbness to go away. And you and I can understand that, right? But it becomes so obsessive to them that this is their worship center. And if something you say as a helper is not going to make them happy, then I don't know if I can buy into that. And so that's where you get sometimes, yeah, I know, but I've tried the God thing. I've had so many people tell me that. I tried the God thing and it didn't work. Well, I say, no, I don't really think you understood the God thing. I don't know what you tried, but when you get a dose of the God that I know, it does work. It really does work. I try not to let them get away with that statement. Or I'll say, like, well, what have you found has worked for you? How's your medication working? Well, pretty good when the doctor ups my dosage. Yeah. Is that the way you want to live the rest of your life? You know. There's four key questions to life, isn't there? You know? Like, is the way you're living right now making you really satisfied? Are you really content with the life that you're living right now? Contentedness is a learned state, Paul says. I want to tell you something. If there's something you're discontent about, you've taken the first step to open the door to Satan's temptation. But that's another seminar. But just, and then, is the way you're living right now, does it satisfy the highest demands of your conscience? Can you pillow your head in perfect peace? And is the way you're living right now preparing you for death? Are you ready to die right now? Has everything been taken care of? And then number four, the way you are right now, are you ready to stand before God? Are you ready to stand before God? Those are critical questions, aren't they? A person with the wrong idol. And then the last one is a massive ingratitude. And you'll see this as we go on to the next one after our break. I want to jump ahead a little bit. We can go back and pick up some of this stuff. But I want to jump ahead, and I want to actually put what we've learned to work with our case. So let's cover this last one. That is mass ingratitude. Ingratitude says, I deserve better. I don't deserve this treatment. And the depressed person is really saying, I don't think I deserve to feel like this. I don't think any human being should have to feel like I feel. And it's like they're so caught in their own mass of nothing being bigger than them that it's like, I deserve this. I want a benefit. If I am going to talk with you, you better be ready to give me a benefit because I deserve it. Boy, that's a hard person to counsel. That's a hard person to help sometimes because they feel they deserve instant relief. They cannot comprehend a Bible term of suffering or hurting. That is no place for suffering in their economy. So, we're going to talk about more. Let's take a quick break here, and then we'll come back and we'll have. It's going to surprise you who's going to be. Well, it won't surprise you. We're going to have Shelley. She's going to come. Shelley's going to come in. That's not her real name. You'll know who her real name is. So, it's 7:51 according to Steve's dial watch here. So let's try to come back so we don't lose too much time. Just stand up, kind of relax, enjoy one another's company. If you need to use the facilities, you know where they are at. And we'll try to come back in about 4 minutes. Okay, we'll have a pianist play or something and give you a. You know, I'm simply saying that to get started. If you take 5 or 7 minutes, it's not going to depress me at all.
4 minutes is pretty high expectations.
Greg, my friend, said 4 minutes is pretty high expectations. Okay, I'll give you 4.5. 5. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Oh, yeah. Good.
I want to be an encourager for people.
Storms have a purpose. Wow, that's true.
And these are just samples from the what I call a parable.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
side as you find your way back to your seats. Thought we could sing number 384. I just look and we don't
have
it.
Now?
I thought maybe we could sing Don't Worry, Be Happy.
I'm gonna, yeah, can you hear me?
Instead,
I'm going to
we'll just do 384. I just keep trusting
Ruth,
my Lord. We can
Simon,
do that one together.
And she's going to be showing.
If you'd like to stand, you can. If you want to keep stretching your legs, we can do that. 384, if you're just joining us. I just keep trusting my Lord as I walk alone. I just keep trusting my Lord, and He gives a song. Those storm clouds darken the sky, or the heavenly trail. I just keep trusting my Lord, He will never fail. Such a faithful friend, I can count on Him to the very end. Though storm clouds darken the sky or the heavenly trail, I just keep trusting my Lord, He will never
Okay. Well, if you have the... Thank you, Aaron. There's just before, so we don't lose the opportunity here, you have a sheet that has on it Tri-City Counseling Connect. Okay? And Pastor and I have discussed the possibilities of what we want to do, how we want to continue to proceed with seminars like this that can really be helpful to you helping people. As you see, there's a place for your name and email address on here, and then your connection interest. If you would like to receive regular updates, I'm going to begin working with my son Matt when I can catch up to him. I would like to receive regular updates regarding counseling tools to help others. If you would like to, we're in the process right now. I'm in the process of launching a website for Church Care Ministries, and we're going to have some regular counseling tools on there. But until those things get developed, if you would like to have some regular tools, one of the things that we would like to send you is key questions, or I'd like to send you is key questions of helping depressed people. And then we'll send you regular updates about depression. Also, if you have questions, you can have the freedom to email us, or you would like to be a part of a network helping others. You say, I don't know that I could ever counsel another person. Well, yes, I believe you could, but we need a prayer team. Pastor needs a prayer team. The deacons here need a prayer team. The Sunday school teachers here need a prayer team. You as a church member need a prayer team. And so we can have a praying network of people. And so if you want to be part of that, or if you would want to connect with someone, let's say there's a person in New Jersey that is having a problem of depression because they lost a child. And I know that you went through that and God taught you things through that. You realize how influential your life can become? As Paul wrote to us in Corinthians and says that the things that I went through, they weren't purposeless. They were for helping others. Or if you'd actually like to be involved in coaching or helping others, we would love to consider that as we build on this. And then some, you know, you're attending the seminar for personal enrichment, and Lord willing, we would like to. We've talked to, of course, pastors on the board for Rocky Mountain Biblical Counseling Center, and we would like to initiate a program with the counseling center to start a certificate program to show that people went through a certain degree of training. This is different from certification. Certification puts you through state hoops and other things that you have to go through. But if you're interested, and I know that some of you have been to the wonderful conference in Lafayette, that we would count that toward credit will probably work up to having so many hours. And what we would like to do is obviously have a counseling team here at Tri-City, where if pastor runs into a situation, he said, let me connect you with one of our church members. I've already pounded on Ched's shoulder a little bit and said, would you help people who are going through financial things? And since I've mentioned it publicly, I know he's going to do that. No, I know him well enough to know he would love to help. But there are people that are going through difficulty, and that's what we're here for. We're here to serve others. And so take time to complete this and just leave it on the table out there. We'll try to do that. Okay, we are ready. You have the case in front of you called Sheld Shelley. We read it last night. And so guess what? Let me introduce to you Sheld Shelley. This is Ruth Simon, and so she has come for counseling. Her name is Shelley tonight, and so we are going to just, and this is where we would like for you to interact and ask questions and say, why did you say that? Why did you do that? Or you can be thinking of things, well, this is what I would have said, because everyone has their own items of what they can say to people. But you've read the case of Sheld Shelley. We read it last night. And so let's kind of work through this, because this is really what counseling is all about. It's really about being able to sit across the table from someone and being able to talk to them and see the Holy Spirit open their heart to truth. And see the words that you say become so rich and so powerful that it's transformational in their life. And that's really, and isn't it fun to be used of the Lord and to see when you have the opportunity to see someone come to know the Lord in your presence and bow their heart before God and ask Jesus Christ to be their Savior? You know, you just jump up and down. It just gives you chills. But that's just the beginning, isn't it? Because now you have a responsibility of a new baby there, and you have to care for that new baby. So you've read the case of Shelley. So Shelley's here. And so I always pray, because I always want God involved in counseling, in my counseling. It's not me as a counselor. It's always about Him. And so, but there's a few things I talk to the Lord about when I pray. I don't pray a long prayer typically, unless I'm real tired and I need a break. No. I shouldn't. Well, this is being taped. I won't say it. I'll tell you sometime later, okay? At the end, you remind me to tell you what happened one time. It's so embarrassing. But anyways, so I pray and I ask the Lord. I ask the Lord to give me wisdom. I say, Lord, this is your child. And in this case, Shelley's saved. So, Lord, this is your child. You've brought her here for this point, this time, to share with her your wisdom and your truth. And then here's what I ask for. I also ask the Lord for this. Help Shelley, as I talk with her, to be able to be honest about the battles and the struggles that she's facing. And the reason that is people have two levels that they deal on. And this is the hardest aspect of counseling. They come to you on the respectable level, and it's hard to get them to the real level. You know the difference between the respectable and real? The respectable level is, pastor says, well, how can I help you, Greg? Well, pastor, I'm just trying to figure out God's will for my life. And I need to read my Bible, pastor. And I need to pray more. And I need to be faithful at the church more. Who doesn't? Right? You need to read your Bible more? I do. You need to pray more? I do. And you feel like saying, Greg, get honest with me. What are you battling in your life? What's the greatest temptation you're facing right now? What sin have you been dabbling in? What's going on in your life right now? What are you struggling with? You know, it's like the person at the back of the church on Sunday morning. You get greeted. How are you doing today?
Just fine. Just fine, brother.
Just had a fight with my wife and yelled at my kids on the way in, but I'm just fine now. Wouldn't you like to hear somebody say, I'm terrible. I can hardly wait for the pastor to just cut loose on me. I've been angry this week. I've been stubborn this week. I'm a mess. I've been so unkind to my home, with my kids, my wife. Man, I'm just ready for the pastor just to hammer me a good one. You say, hey, go ask him how he's doing this morning. We have a new game going on here at the church. It's called honesty. Wouldn't you like that every once in a while? Just people just be flat out honest with you. Yeah. Well, let's go to Shelley. So pray, ask the Lord for wisdom to help, ask for honesty, and then I always thank the Lord for the person He sent across my path. Lord, you've sent Shelley here today, and I have the privilege of talking with her and seeing Your greatness unfold in her life. So I lift my, from bowing my head, I've read what she said. I've got this before. She said this. She might repeat some of these things. And I say, well, Shelley, I'm so glad that you're here today. I really understand what you're saying that you are going through right now. I know with having 5 children and the age range that you have, You have some real challenges. Why do I say that? Because I want her in some way to understand that I understand. And people have to know that you understand and that you care. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And so I have to help her understand in some way that I understand. I help her to understand that I understand and that I care. Shelley, let me ask you this question. What you've talked about depression, what would you say if I were to ask you what is the greatest struggle that you're facing in your life right now, what would you say?
There's so many things.
Let's try it again. You're going to get depressed over this.
I am.
Steve, rescue me. What do I do? It's red. The little who? Oh, it's green now. Yes, it's green now. You're a genius.
There's so many hard things. There's so much going on, and I just can't manage it all. There's the kids, and I can't keep track of them. They're just difficult to deal with, and then there's all the stuff at church, and I'm trying so hard to serve, and then my husband, he just won't even come home, and he won't spend time with me, and he just leaves everything undone, and he won't help me, and he's never there for me, and that's just, it's so hard. That's probably the worst thing, is that he's never there for me.
So really what you're saying is all of this seems to be just crushing you, and you don't know where to turn. You don't know what to do and how to handle this situation. All right, now I want to stop here. And Steve, I'm going to pull a bad one on you. Okay, a little bit of a bad one. And I want you to follow with me because we understand the situation. And I can, but now that we have this information, this is where the tool that I want to share with you comes to life. All right, and so. Steve, if you can work with me, go to the slide that has Discovering Depression's Dynamics. It's, I think, beautiful. Thank you, sir. Now, you all have that on your sheet, okay? Now, this is a tool that if you understand the concept, and if you don't, Ruth, you're doing a terrific job, by the way. If you get this concept, you're going to be able to help people in so many different ways. That's why I call it Discovering Depression's Dynamics. What counsel can I offer for depression? And so notice, and I'm going to go to the whiteboard here for this. Notice the idea before you. Here's the idea that you see. Shelley lives in this real world. She just began to unload and say what this real world looks like. The real world of her husband, the real world of being crushed by the kids, the things that are going on, etc. Now, notice the real world in which we live is a world that involves responsibility. All right? She lives in a world of daily responsibility. What are her responsibilities? She's got children. She's got a husband that's acting not right and not a loving husband as Christ loved the church, etc. So, the real world of responsibility that you and I live in every day is a world that sometimes doesn't taste good to us. Let me get your help here. And so I'm making sure that you're with me and on my page. What is there about the real world? And this is not a complicated question. Name something in the real world day by day that you face that you really don't like. For example, let me give you an example. My wife is so wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. But I know after being married to her for 44 years that one thing that she doesn't like is ironing. Okay? Not that she won't do it, not that she hasn't done it, but for the last several years she has bought me wrinkle-free shirts. Does that tell you something? And she, you know, whenever I go to Goodwill and I find I like Brooks Brothers shirts, but I can only afford them at Goodwill. And so when I find a Brooks Brothers shirt, she reads the label. Now, is that number 436 or whatever? Because only the 436 ones are wrinkle-free, non-iron shirts. Okay? So that's distasteful. And when she had Matthew and David and our other children in the home, at 12 years old, our kids learned how to iron clothes. And I only tell you this, but you got to block this off the tape, Steve, that my daughters-in-law can't even iron as good as my sons can. But that's because their mother taught them how to iron like a perfectionist, you know. So, okay, cut it out. You never heard that from me, okay? So what is there like in your world sometimes that's distasteful to you? Just shout it out. Disagreements. Conflict. Everybody hates conflict. I join you on that one. Okay? Something that you're disagreeing over, you just can't come to a consensus on. Absolutely. That's a great one. What else? Traffic. Okay? There's another real one, right? I faced it today. Thought I would miss it. I didn't. Boy, you hit a winner there, Jason. A lack of time. Just not having enough time. Okay? Another one. Somebody shout out another one. Not getting done on your time. Not getting done on your time. That's good. Somebody else. Another one. There you... Oh, man. That's convicting. Now you're getting on all of us. Did you hear what she said, Joe? Did you hear what she said, Pastor? Elise is staying young. I don't understand that. We can't do things as fast as you once did. I got a new one. Forgetting things. You know, it's almost fearful. Am I getting Alzheimer's or what? You know? Man, I can't find keys. I can't find glasses. I can't find stuff. You know, I'm trying to get my wife to tell me what I did with stuff. And so... you know, these are normal, just regular things in life that become distasteful. Now watch this, because is this what's happened? Now, these are kind of real things that we talked about, but they're not like life-threatening things for the most part. But imagine Shelley in a marriage where her husband is never there, just she described it. The kids are complaining every day. And her house is a mess. The younger kids are undisciplined, disorderly. And her world's crushing in on her. I mean, it's not like she's, you know, let me say this. It's not like she's facing a divorce. It's not like she's just had a miscarriage. But in her mind, it's the most severe issue that she's facing. And it's creating depression. Now, notice what we do when we get caught in that world. What we do not do is run to the Lord. What we do not do is see God's goodness. What we do not do is seek His purposes. Watch what we do. And we've all done this. We run to a world of fantasy. I call it an I wish world. Okay? I wish this were different. I wish this never happened. I wish I could just go to an island for a while. I wish we could just get some furniture for a change instead of having to get boats and golf clubs and guns. Why can't we get something meaningful in our life? Could I just get some furniture? Is that too much to ask? So we all run to our wish places. I wish I had more money. I wish our budget weren't so tight. I wish I had more time. This is the natural way that we, in our own strength, in our own self, this is what we do. We run to an I wish world. Can you imagine? Well, let's ask. And normally I'll show you how we're going to counsel Shelley in a minute. But Shelley, let me ask you this question. What do you wish? Tell me the three things that you wish most for in your life. Tell me three things that you wish were so different in your life right now.
What would be? It'd be great if my husband came and like brought me flowers and talked to me and took me to dinner and like wanted to be with me, and it'd just be great if he just spent time with me and he helped me around the house and he helped with the clothes and with the kids and he spent time talking to them and he helped me get dinner ready and with the dishes and just if he supported me, that's what I would wish.
You hear that, Wayne? Just kidding. There's always a liability when you let your wife do something like this. Okay. So, and she's very accurate, very good, Ruth. Very excellent. That's exactly what that's exactly what I heard her say. Something similar. Okay, now, so she ran to this I wish world. But watch what's happening on the inside. Okay? Because that's what we're interested in. And on the inside, when you go to an I wish world and a fantasy world in your mind, on the inside, you begin to resent the real world in which you live. The job gets ugly. I hate this job. I just don't like that. What's going on? I just wish there were only four people in our church, so that the pastor could pay all of his give all of his attention to me. Why does there have to be so many people here? What are we trying to do anyways? Win people to Jesus and help them to grow? I mean, can't we just have our own little bless me group? Do you see these seats? What if we had some dirty kids on these seats? That would be terrible. You know? And if we had a bunch of people in here with tattoos and stuff on them, that would be bad. You know, there's all kinds of crazy things in our mind that we wish for. But here's the danger. The danger is we begin to resent reality in which we live. All right? Now, there's several ways that resentment expresses itself. We talked a little bit about them. But one is we resign. I give up. I'm not putting up with this anymore. You notice that at the end of Shelley's, of her case. I just feel like leaving my husband, my children, my home, my church, leaving it all. And some people, that's what they do. They resign. Some people, they keep running, but they run beyond their wishes. They run into alcohol. They run into substance abuse. They run into some life-threatening habit. They're on the run. Others seek to get revenge. I'm going to get back. I'm going to strike back. Nobody's going to do that to me and get away with it. I'll fix them. I'll get them. So these are the modes that people choose. The major modes that people choose. There are others. Some try what I call to resolve. And although it seems like a good word, it's not in this case, because they want to get around the problem, avoidance. They want to do it their own way. They want resolution, but the only way they want resolution is if it's done their way. And they'll say, I'm seeking resolution. No, you're not. You're really seeking to have it done your way. There's a difference. And so, in this case, resolve isn't a good word. So this is what they do. Now watch. Watch what happens. When I resent responsibility, I become irresponsible. Okay? Once I resent responsibility, and please don't think if my wife were here, I would say it in front of her, but she would say, "Oh, honey, I think I got 25 shirts to iron. I don't want to even start, but I'm going to go down there." And sometimes I would wake up literally at 1:30 in the morning, and I would say, "Where's my wife? Where are you, Susan? Where are you?" And I would go down in the basement, and I would find her ironing shirts. I would pull the plug on the iron. "You are going to bed and get some rest. You can't do this. I'm not going to allow you to wear yourself out. I can wear a wrinkled shirt. I got a sport coat I can pull over." "No, you're not wearing a wrinkled shirt and getting up in front of people in chapel and stuff like that." "Okay. All right. But, well, you're going to bed right now. Let's go." So, and later she would thank me for it, for coming. But you begin to resent, and then you act irresponsible. Now, that's just a simple illustration, and I only use that illustration to show you what happens. When you become irresponsible, you go into some people's homes and there's irresponsibility. Dishes are piled up and they have a dishwasher. What's with that? You know? Don't say you don't have time. Let's get to the truth. And so we have to get to the truth with Shelley here. Once you become irresponsible, now this is particularly true of a believer. It doesn't affect an unbeliever this way. Once you become irresponsible as a believer, you become guilty inside. Why? Because it's God's way of trying to turn your heart toward Him. To him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, it's sin. And when sin comes into our heart, and sometimes we don't recognize it as sin. That's why God gets us into a body of believers. That's why you hear messages from different truths. And if I saw the read the bulletin right, you guys are going through John, I believe. Oh, what a precious book. And what a book where you can see, you know, you get to John chapter 9 and you see that interaction with Jesus, and he talks about the Pharisees being blind and they don't even know what he's talking about. They're so blind they don't know what he's talking about. And but you get guilty. When you get guilty inside, then what happens? You become depressed because you and I aren't built to handle guilt. The human soul, the way God designed it, God never designed you and I to know sin by experience. He never designed Adam and Eve to know sin by experience. That's why the tree of knowledge of good and evil was in the garden. Because God did not want man to experience sin, because he knew that the soul that sinneth would die. But they became independent. They wandered outside of God's boundaries. They made their own choices. They were made in God's image. They could make choices. God did not make robots. And so when you get guilty, you get depressed or angry, and it comes out in a multitude of ways. Now, you see that? You got the concept? Now we're going to use this model and we're going to help Shelley with it. You can use this model. This is a fantastic model to use in depression, but you can also use it to help other, to do other issues in your life. Anyone have any questions so far? You kind of got the concept of the model? Let's play it out in Shelley's life and then let's see how it works. Okay? Shelley? And so... Shelley, let me draw something out that I think will help you. And usually in my office, I have a big tablet. If I had an office now, I would have Steve come and put screens in and do this on like you're seeing it. But I draw it out, and I say, Shelley, let me show you what you're telling me. See if this doesn't fit. I think this will help you. Shelley, you live in a real world here. Every day you're telling me you face things. Your husband plays golf in the afternoon. You see, every afternoon he's in an afternoon golf league. You are concerned because you think he may get dismissed from his job. And that's a concern to you. And he's never there for you. That you said this is one of your huge struggles. And you would like him to be there. And then your children and your household, things are becoming a pressure. Shelley, what we have a tendency to do when these things crowd in on us is we, in our mind, wish things were different. I noticed that you said sometimes you just feel like leaving everything. And you've told me you wish things were so different. You wish your husband would be home. You wish he'd be there for you. You wish the children would be more respectful. And so you really wish these things would be different. But Shelley, let me, if I can, and I know this may be difficult to understand, but listen. What happens is we begin to live over here in our lives. We begin to live wishing things were so different than they are. And when we do that, this world over here becomes very depressing to us, because this is the world we live in. We would much rather live over here where our marriage were different, things were happier, the children would be responsible, the house would be cleaned up, everything would be in order in our lives and in our home. And I know that's what you're saying that you want. Now notice how I'm trying to prepare, and you have to do this when you're counseling. You have to prepare a person mentally for the bomb that you're about to drop on them, okay? Because if you don't, they will misinterpret or misunderstand you, and they'll think you don't care. Shelley, watch this. When we live in this world, our tendency is to become hurt inside. And we begin, in this case, you began to almost resent your husband. You began to say to these kids, I mean, it's almost like you're resentful. Could I ask you that? Have you ever felt like, Lord, I wish you'd have given me another husband that would have been more responsible? Have you ever had those thoughts?
Well, yes, because if I had another husband, he'd probably spend time with me. And if I had different kids, I mean, do you know what it's like having five kids? They don't even say thank you. They don't even spend time noticing that I do stuff for them. The little ones, they just argue and fuss and complain, and it's like they don't even notice all that I do. I spend all day serving them. They don't even notice. They don't even care. That's why it's better for me to just spend time at the church, because at least when I'm at the church, did you see the missions banquet that I helped coordinate? Then people said thank you for that. People noticed that.
I heard about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Notice how her feelings are expressing her heart, right? Her feelings are revealing what's in her heart. She's doing a very good job here. Shelley, that resentment causes you to put all of your time and energy into the church. And I'm going to write another word here. I'm going to write the word irresponsibility down. Now notice, I'm going to go quickly to the conclusion, and then I'm going to come back and I'm going to help her. Shelley, when a person becomes irresponsible, notice that transition I made. I didn't say, Shelley, when you become irresponsible. I said, Shelley, when a person becomes irresponsible, they are guilty inside. They become depressed. So you can see how your life is traced to the depression. Now, you say, okay, how can I turn things around? How can things be turned around in my life? Shelley, let me ask you a question. You're a Christian, what is the greatest responsibility that you believe you have as a Christian?
Well, I'm supposed to serve God. That's what I'm doing, all these activities. I'm spending all this time serving them. Isn't that what I'm supposed to be doing?
You're doing so well, Ruth, that's exactly what the lady asked me. She exactly said that phrase. Isn't that what I'm supposed to be doing? She used that phrase. Shelley, Jesus, who is our wonderful example, was asked a question. He was asked it by a group of lawyers they were trying to trap Jesus. And they asked Jesus this question. You might remember it from messages that you've heard at church. It's all throughout the Old Testament. In fact, it's one of the most familiar phrases about love in the Old Testament. But Jesus was asked this question, and here was the question. What is the greatest commandment of all, or the greatest commandment of the law? Do you recall ever hearing that verse?
Yeah, I'm supposed to love God.
Uh-huh. Love God with what? Do you remember the end of that verse?
Was it with all my heart, and with all my soul, and with all my mind, and with all my strength?
And then he said there's a second commandment that's like unto it. Remember what he said that was?
Love others.
Love others. Love your neighbor as yourself, in fact, he said. Let me ask you a question. If I were to ask you, what's one of the greatest ways that I can, as an individual, experience a personal relationship with God? What is one of the greatest areas of my life that needs personal attention? What is one of the greatest opportunities that God has given me as a Christian to get close to Him in a relationship with Him? What would you say that is?
Well, love the people I'm around.
Okay, that would be one, certainly. I'm sure you've heard this, that God's Word is like a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. The truth of God's Word guides our life. It keeps us on track. Proverbs says there's nothing like God's wisdom, and His wisdom is found in the Bible. You know that. Could I ask you, if you don't mind, could I ask you a personal question? How much time would you say that you spend giving attention to your own personal walk with God, in the sense of opening God's Word and saying, God, show me what Shelley's really like. Teach me about how Shelley can be more like Jesus. How much time would you say, on the average, that you spend in your Bible each day?
Well, you know how hard it is to get all the kids to school and get them ready?
Yes.
It's like really hard to do that. But I will try. I mean, like probably like at least two or three times a week I like read a verse or two. I mean, like sometimes I'll like remember one when I'm driving the kids or something like that.
Sure, sure. If I said, Shelley, for the next week, I am going to make sure that I'm going to ask you to come and live with a family in the church. Now, you need to be aware of this, that for next week, you're only going to eat three times. Okay? And it's just going to be a little Rice Krispie bar. Okay? And I may throw in some M&Ms. And now you can drink some water, but you're only going to eat three times all week. And it's just going to be a quick, fast food, junk food. What would you say? Do you embrace that? Is that what you would like to do?
Well, it's going to be hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right.
Probably not going to feel like
and enough. It wouldn't be very healthy if I just give you a Rice Krispie bar, would it? Or a Twinkie. You know, no. Right, I know. I know how you feel about that. I feel the same way. Let me ask you this, Shelley. One of the greatest, most fantastic ways that we have to communicate with God, I mean, to talk with the Maker of the universe, to talk with our Creator every day, is to pray. I know, I'm sure that you pray over your breakfast and lunch and dinner. Let me ask you this. Jesus talked about a time that every person should have. The disciples asked him about it in Luke 11. They said, Lord, teach us to pray. And he said, pray after this model. But in Matthew chapter 6, he said, when you pray, don't be like people that are just religious, ritualistic people that stand in street corners. He said, I want you to spend personal time. He called it closet, the prayer closet. Go into your closet and pray. And the reason is, when you're away from the crowd, that God can say to Shelley, I want to draw near to you, and I want you to draw near to me. I want to take away this depression. I want to see your life changed, like you've never had it changed before. I want you to spend time with me, just like you're longing for your husband to spend time with you. God is saying to Shelley, I long for you to spend time with me. Let me ask you a question. How much time do you spend just alone? I'm not talking about just driving or whatever. I'm talking about just personal time where you go and you're alone with God and you're saying, God, search me and show me what you have for me and how you want to change my life. How much time would you spend like every day doing that?
Not much. Maybe a minute.
Maybe a minute? Let me ask you another question. God says that He gave you, and I'm going to jump a little bit, and I'm going to go faster now, okay? Because I want to touch several bases for you. God said that He gave you this precious gift called marriage. This gift is a gift where He can use your husband to see your life change. God puts people in our life to show us what we are and to show us how we can be more like Christ. I know you may think that's a big stretch. How can my husband, who's neglecting me, show me how to be more like Jesus? But you know what your husband is testing, in a sense? He doesn't even realize it. In fact, he shouldn't be acting like this with you. But your husband is showing how much the depth of your ability to love someone else is. And you just told me a minute ago that the command of Jesus was to love others. And so you're having a difficulty right now loving your husband. And God's saying, Shelley, I want to increase your capacity to love, because it's the fruit of the Spirit. The fruit of the Spirit is love. If you don't start there, it's like a canopy for all of the other fruits of the Spirit. And you probably know the list. And so God wants you to love your husband in spite of how he is treating you. And he's teaching you. He wants to get your attention to do that. But, as you see on the chart, when we act irresponsibly in our life, you begin to resent your husband. And then the children. Think of the children. You have to think of whose children they are. They're a gift of the Lord. Many people would love to have 5 children. They're a gift of God. And you know, when you neglect that gift, when you neglect the stewardship of caring for them and helping them be orderly and helping them grow in their faith in Jesus Christ, who is at your home showing them the example of Christ? You know what? You're running over here to the church, which is an admirable thing that you do for the church. But if you said to Jesus, Lord, I think you're really pleased with all of my time at the church, instead of me spending time in your word, instead of me talking to you and spending time with you, instead of me loving my husband, instead of me caring for my children and helping them, and instead of being a testimony and reaching my neighbors with the gospel, you put on a great mission conference. The pastor told me about how fantastic of a job you did. But Shelley, your neighbor's going to hell. Your neighbor is going to hell. And you're more concerned about what your neighbor thinks about your clean home than you are about her soul. There's nothing in your report that you showed me about how that you've tried to invite your neighbor over. You can't. Your house is a mess because you've acted irresponsibly. And until all of these things, now I probably wouldn't say all of this in one mouthful like I'm telling you, but I would get to it, and so I'm saying it in a mouthful to speed it up for you guys. But I'm going to hammer every base of biblical responsibility that is before this woman. Because until she sees her biblical responsibility, nothing else matters. This world is not about her. It's not about us. It's about Him and His purposes. It's about His glory. And right now, she's glorifying, and I may get a chance to tell her this, right now she's glorifying herself. I'm the church activities coordinator. Look at all I'm doing. I'm pleasing God. I'm performing for God. And I'm afraid sometimes that in our Christian experience, we're so busy performing for God that we forgot our relationship with God. And families fall apart. And if you ask a wife, is your husband loving you like Christ loved the church? No, he really loves his boat. We've missed the basics. We've grown accustomed to a Christianity that's in a cycle of busy performance instead of biblical responsibility. Now, I'm not going to tell her, don't do anything for the church, because that's part of her biblical responsibility to her local church. But I am going to say something like, in the days ahead when we meet again, Shelley, we need to have a talk. You need to have a talk with your pastor and tell him that your life is a mess. You're bitter at your husband. Your kids are disorderly. Your children are gone to pot. And by the way, as a responsible mother, she has a 17-year-old who's complaining about her not doing the laundry. What? That kid should have been doing the laundry at 10. Right? And the house is not cleaned up. What? Something's wrong, right? Something's wrong with that picture. And so, we're really going to teach her what? Her first responsibility is her responsibility to walk with the Lord. Isn't that our first responsibility? Our first responsibility of life. The highest quality of our life is to do what? Glorify God. To bring God pleasure. To honor God. And we honor God when we have a vibrant relationship with Him. When we worship Him. Not our job. Even if it's at the church. She's worshiping her job. She bows to the idol of applause. Oh, great missions conference. Great activities coordinator. Shelley, we could never do it without you. Well, what if I died tomorrow? Well, we've had another activities coordinator. That's what we do. You know? In the meantime, her marriage is going down the tubes. I would talk to her about bringing her husband, see if her husband would come from counsel, because I'd put the hammer down on that guy, you know, and talk to him about his biblical responsibility. I may even have her bring the kids in at some point just to speak to them about honoring their parents. And, you know, but I would get her being the example in the home first. Can you imagine living with this lady? When are you going to come home and quit that golfing all the time? You're going to get fired. That's what you're going to get. How would you like to come home to that every day? Huh? Sure, he's acting like a jerk. But can you imagine what she's doing? Can you imagine? You kids, this house is a mess. You know, get over there and pick up that stuff. You know, I'm busy at the church and I'm working late every night. You get this stuff cleaned up. You get this house cleaned up. Show me, Mom. How do I do that? Show me, Mom, how I'm undisciplined when you just lost it with your tongue. You didn't speak to me with grace, like Ephesians 4 says. Show me. You see the picture here of what we're dealing with? And so we have to bring the person into a point of biblical responsibility. Okay? We don't want... Okay, now let's take questions. Thank you. Terrific, terrific job, Ruth. Let's give her a hand. She did a great job. She deserves it. Appreciate that. Question? Yes? Oh, yeah. Proverbs 31, the virtuous woman. You know, here's the, can I say this? You're exactly right. And I would get there, although I wouldn't say, you need to be a Proverbs 31 woman, you know. Because here's what happens. And you might disagree with me, and you might give me a dirty look after I say this. When you're counseling people, they cannot feel like you're preaching down at them. They have to feel like you're coming alongside them. And that you're entering into their world. And that you understand. That doesn't take away the power of the truth. That enables you to get the truth deeper into their soul. Okay? So sometimes I would have liked to reach across the desk and get the husband and say, "Wake up! Quit being a jerk!" But that's probably not a good way to counsel, you know. And so, but you have to bring people along with you, and you have to enter their world. But great comment. And you weave this. Listen, can I say it like this without a misunderstanding? If you misunderstand, raise your hand. I'll try to clarify. The Bible should be such a part of us that we don't quote verses. We speak truth. Does that make sense? In other words, I don't have to say the beginning. To fear the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. I can say, you know what? To think about how awesome God is and the power that He has and the fact that He sees and watches everything I do, that makes me give consideration to Him and what He says I need to do and how He says I need to live. You know what I just told you? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. I didn't quote the verse to you. I told you something about how to live it. And that's what we have to do with people. Now, that doesn't mean we can't quote powerful Bible verses. Please don't misunderstand me. But we need to translate. We need to reframe for people so they know how to live. Because so often we can just click off verses to people. And they'll say, here's what a wife will say. Yeah, I know, I heard that verse. I'm supposed to submit to my husband. But if I say something like this, you know, the Bible has a wonderful picture of how you can be protected and be pressure-free in many areas of your life. And it's a picture of how we should live in our relationship with Christ. And that we should honor Him and be surrendered to Him and seek to please Him. You know what I just told you as a woman? Submit. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. As a husband, you know what you need to do? You need to go shopping with your wife when you don't feel like it. You need to set aside that golf game and say, you know, sweetheart, you are more important to me than playing golf with my buddies. I want to be with you today. You know what I just told you? Husbands, love your wives. You see what I mean? Make the Bible such a part of you because you're in it. All the time. You hear it preached well. You make the Bible so much a part of you that it's like it's alive. This is how I live. This is the way the gospel works. That makes sense. Because, you know, I've quoted Bible verses to people and they say, "I heard that before." Okay. Well, let me tell you it a different way then. And so you begin to do that, and you begin to see God use the power of His Word, because that's what you're doing. You're using the power of His Word to interject into the lives of people. Let's pick up a couple. Any other questions? I don't want to leave the questions, and we're going to get out of here. Oh, in 2 minutes, I guess. 8:58. Well, almost 1 minute. But Steve, go back to the slide real quick. Oh yes, let's talk about that. That's terrific. Let's go to this one. And I'll explain this one. And then I'll use the feeling slide, you know, I'm afraid, I fear, or whatever. I'll send some information to you on that, okay? Because that's another language that the depressed people use. And that's where they live, in a world of fear. They're paralyzed with it. In a world of shame, where they're guilty. In a world of anger, where they didn't get something they want. So they live in that world. But I can't leave you without this one. This is a simple chart. In fact, Mrs. Sin quoted this tonight, and she didn't even realize what she was doing. I told her, I said, this is what we're going to talk about tonight. Defeating depression's dominance. What will conquer my depression? The depression cycle untangled. Notice on the left side, or whatever side you're looking at, is a self-focus. This is the heart of depression. The ideal is only what is good for me. And you see, when you live in that cycle, what happens? Worry, fear, nervousness, jealousness. I can explain this more, but I'm going to get you out as close to the time allotted as I can. And so this is the self-focus. Once you begin down the road of depression, then it begins to get really cluttered. And other ideas, you know, you have to remember that this Christian life is a war. It is a battle. And so Satan's saying, he's always accusing, God is not good. There's always something he's saying about God and his character. There's always that whisper out there. And the minute I question this, is the minute my mind just opens and floods my soul with depression. The minute I question the goodness of God. The best way to defeat that is to understand and to help people understand that every good and perfect gift comes from the Father of above. And that God's, here's the overriding feature, that God's purposes are grand and glorious. At the same time, I have to use the Bible terminology for the hurting and the pain and the suffering. And I have to help them understand that the Christian life does involve that. And I'll try to incorporate some little things that as Pastor and I interact, to send and to get your way, to give you to think on these things. But the idea, the self-focus idea, is that the ideal is only what is good for me. So here's how people interpret life. They interpret life on the basis of, how will this affect me? This is the lens in which life is interpreted. In other words, Pastor Bart or Pastor Larry gets up and says, we are going to have a fantastic time. We are going to have a conference on a missions conference. And, you know, it's going to be Monday through Friday. Larry, are you sick? Don't you know that I come to church, if I can make it on Wednesday, it's good. And you want me to come to church every night for a week? What have you been taking, Pastor? What happened? I immediately forgot about missions. I forgot about, you know, what we do as a church to pray and support, and things that we do every week of the year to do this. And I said, my schedule is affected by what you have said we're going to do at the church. Now, that's exactly why in most churches, 10% of the people do 90% of the work. Because people look at life on the basis of how this is going to affect my time, my schedule, me. And that's just one area of life. A neighbor says, can you come over? And you've been witnessing to this neighbor, and you've maybe invited them into your home. And a neighbor says, boy, I need some help. I need some help moving. And you say, well, I sure can't do it Saturday morning, because that's my tea time. You guys are going to think I hate golf. I love golf. I'm no good at it, but I like it. I don't love it. My wife might say I do love it. You know, I can never do that. I would miss a tea time with the boys. How impressed would that neighbor be who's unsaved if you would say, you know, I have a really important golf appointment on Saturday, but you know what? You know what Jesus told me? He said that I was to love you so much as my neighbor that I need to come over and help you move. I'll be there Saturday. You can count on me. That neighbor, that unsaved neighbor is saying, you think like Jesus. What's up with that? He goes in and tells his wife. He said, you know what that guy, you know what my neighbor's doing? He's giving up a golf game to help me move. You know what he told me? He said that would be being like Jesus. Maybe we ought to check into going to his church with him just once, at least for him helping to move. And he comes to church. He comes under conviction of the Word of God, and he comes to know Christ. Why? Just because you gave up a golf game to help the guy move. We just don't think like that. And you got a huge resource there of wonderful senior saints, at least in my mind. I had the opportunity to speak to them. What a great resource of prayer and power could be unleashed by this group of people. You know? And then some of the young families I've met here, terrific. Guy like Jason, we'll get him married and he'll be even more. We'll double his efforts. We'll double his efforts. He's fantastic now. Wait till he gets a good wife, man. He'll be double, you know. He might be the next assistant pastor. Who knows? I don't think he can sing. Maybe we can make him a music pastor or something. You know, at least people will watch him up there with his big arm going, you know. There's so many opportunities out there for us to serve Christ. A Christocentric focus, a Christ-centered focus says, I want to do what glorifies God and serves others. This is how I'm going to order my life. God, you show me what you want me to do that would most glorify you today. That's what I'm going to do. And you show me. You bring people across my path. And teach me how I can serve them. Show me how I can give them the gospel. Give me the right words. Help me to say things your way and live life your way. This is what it's all about, isn't it? So I hope you have enough tools. I hope to put more in your hand, but I think this model is fantastic. I've seen God use it many times. Pastor, why don't you come down and dismiss us officially? Thank you for staying. It's 9:06. I kept you 6 minutes later. Don't forget to complete your connection card if you're interested in receiving further material. Just lay it on the table out there, and we will.